Hello.
Hey, Rocco, it's Eli.
Hey, good morning, Australia.
How's it going where you are?
Pretty good, man. Pretty good. Excited about all the positive feedback from the first episode of the podcast.
It sounds like some people like it.
A couple, maybe a couple do, yeah. Rome wasn't built in a day.
No.
So what's going on?
Just thinking, well, what should we talk about today? What are you reading at the moment, Rocco?
You know, the thing I'm most excited about right now is Velvet.
Mm.
You know, the Edward Baker book.
Yeah, that's great.
And I always get mixed up on the artist because there's two artists that he uses frequently.
Mm.
This one's not Sean. It's the other guy.
Yeah, Steve Epting.
Steve Epting. That's right.
This is the guy who came to fame with on the Captain America run.
Right, yeah. So there's him and there's Sean Phillips, and those are the two artists that he tends to use the most and seems to have a lot of the best work with. And then I'm also reading Sex Criminals, despite its horrible title. And those are probably the two books I'm most excited about right now.
Yeah, I'm really liking Velvet. It's classic Brubaker. And it's, you know, the espionage and it's the noir. It's got all those elements. I think even yourself calling it a sort of Moneypenny coming out from behind the desk.
The Secret Life of Moneypenny, you know, and also a little bit of the Contessa.
Yeah.
From S.H.I.E.L.D. with the gray or the white streak in her hair.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really cool book, man. I'm really digging it.
It's good to see the Brubaker and Epting together on something again. So I think they've done the Captain America, then they did the Marvels project as well, I think, together.
Right, yeah. Which was an all right book, as I recall.
Yeah. I don't think I'd actually knew much about Brubaker until I'd read the Captain America run probably 2 or 3 years into that run, and I went back and picked it up on a lot of people's recommendation.
Yeah, it was a fantastic, fantastic run. And it's very interesting to see what they're doing at Image now, because it shows that they're doing something that is creator-owned and controlled, and they are the very first people to tell the story, and they will be the only ones, more likely than not, to tell these stories.
Mm. So they now got an exclusive deal at Image Comics where they can essentially write what they want.
Yeah, that's what I gather. And also, you'll notice that the way that the book is, the presentation of the book is very similar to the look of Fatale and Criminal, which I think Fatale had been done for Image as well, but Criminal was being done at Marvel under their Milestone, their own creator-owned input, and they've managed to... Or imprint, rather, and they've managed to swirl it on over to Image for business reasons which are unknown to most of us.
And we don't really care because it works out good for us.
Right, yeah. As long as the books are okay and they're getting to tell the stories they want to tell, I'm happy. I'm a happy camper.
So the Fade Out is their next project. So Fatale wraps up, I think, in summer. US summer, so there's about 4 issues left in that run, and then they kick into the Fade Out, which is like a Hollywood 40s noir thing.
I'll need to get on that. To my shame, I didn't keep up with Fatale. I got the first story arc as it was coming out, enjoyed it, and then for whatever reason didn't keep up with it, but I will go back and get those trades.
Mm.
Part of what's great about those books is that the stuff in the bag is always really, really good.
Yeah.
And I'll be sorry to have missed out on that.
Yeah, so they've... So often Ed Brubaker's own back matter, I think he's... the title of his the Secret Ingredient, something like that. But he also, but the
Secret Ingredient.
Yeah, but the essays by Jess Nevins that are in a bunch of the issues are really cool. So, you know, telling the pulp history and particularly in Fatale, going back and talking about horror genre and Cthulhu and Lovecraft and all that type of stuff. It's really fascinating stuff.
Yeah. It was one of the ones in Criminal that turned me on to the Elliot Gould version of The Long Goodbye,
Mm.
which became one of my favorite films once I saw it. 1970s retelling of the Philip Marlowe story.
So I think you'll be in luck because they're going to re-release the Fatales, those nice deluxe hardcovers if you're into that sort of thing. And I believe they're going to be reprinting all the back matter.
Oh, wow. I'm into that. I don't know how much my pocketbook is. We'll have to wait and see on that one.
Yeah, value for money.
Right. Well, the you know, the creators of these books, man, they're really there's really some good rock star creators these days, and they really call their own shots by moving from the big two over to these other companies or getting similar deals with one of the big two as they would at the smaller companies. And in the end, you know, we're the big winners.
It was so Sean Phillips. He's as an artist, you know, he can only pump out so many books a month, and the Brubaker Phillips partnership has kept him pretty much with at least one book a month on the shelves for however long. They've been working together for 15 years. I don't know how long they've had this month to month run. And other than the, he does a bunch of other cover pieces for other books as well. But, Brubaker was still doing a bunch of stuff for Marvel up until recently. And I'll be honest that, you know, I was not really interested in that work for hire stuff outside of the that original Captain America Winter Soldier story and Marvel's project, like we mentioned. I feel like sometimes they get the big guns in for, you know, to give a character or a team on the big two, you know, we'll shake it up and put this big talent on there, but it's not always my thing.
Yeah. And I think that you can start to tell that their heart is wandering when they're on a big two project. You're seeing that a lot now with Matt Fraction. Hawkeye is the other book that I'm really excited about month to month. And it's getting to where it, I don't know if I would go so far as to say that it feels like it's running out of steam, but there were a few issues there. It was coming out more than regularly. It felt like it was coming out every 2 weeks. David Aja is the artist on that most of the time. And it was just this really vital and exciting book. And it feels like ever since Sex Criminals has launched, which is his book and Image, it feels like Hawkeye has slowed down tremendously, both in frequency of the issues coming out and also just in the stories themselves.
But you know what the good thing about that is they haven't gone, shit, we need to fill this month-to-month title, so we'll put somebody else on to fill it in.
Because yeah.
That would, I think everybody knows that would be the death of that title.
Yeah. And, you know, back in the Jim Shooter days, he kept stories lined up all the time in his cabinet for every book. So if somebody was late and they missed the deadline, they would just run a book or run a story. And if the story, if Spider-Man was in his red and blue costume during the time that he was wearing his black one, it would just say this story took place before Secret Wars number 7 or whatever issue that was, and just run with it. And just put it out, and somebody doesn't get paid that month.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, it generally puts you off the sort of the flow that you're in when you're following a bunch of comics. And when there's so many different titles on the shelf at the moment, you get a little bit brutal with, well, fuck it, I'll just drop that title because I've got a lot of other stuff to keep me busy.
I'll drop a book with the quickness, man. You know, it doesn't take much. for me to drop a book because it never seems like it's too difficult to go back and catch up in today's world, you know, with eBay and all the things. I mean, it used to be if you miss an issue of a comic, it was like, well, okay, you have two comic shops in town, and either one of those stores have it, you can't find it at the flea market, they're just never going to find that book. Too bad for you. But now you have a lot more recourse, and especially also with the trades that come out as well.
It's interesting. We actually got some feedback on our conversation last week. Rob Smith. I believe you know Rob Smith.
Oh, I do know Rob, that abysmal brute.
And because we, you know, we both sort of said we're pretty into the street level heroes. But
yeah,
he sort of called you on that and said, you know, your favorite character is Captain Marvel. How can you say you're into street level heroes? I think that's pretty interesting.
Well, my favorite character when I was seven was was Captain Marvel, and I still have that same, you know, that attachment to him. But really, it's not so much Captain Marvel as it is, as I've come to realize, it's Otto Binder, who was the writer, and C.C. Beck, who was the artist. You know, and those comics are so far away from being like anything else that's around now, or really much of anything that was like them at the time, that if you put Captain Marvel into a real world, I mean, we use that phrase, a real world type environment. It's awful, and it would certainly not be something I would consider to be my favorite comic.
No.
You know, it's about the creators over the characters, and outside of a very whimsical Captain Marvel comics of the 40s and their brief return in the 70s, I would say that I'm much more interested in things that have a little bit more bearing in reality.
Yeah, so it's a particular telling of a character that is what you're attached to.
That's right, exactly. Glad Rob is listening. He's a good friend of mine, and I'm glad that he has his own podcast, The Abysmal Brutes, with my other friend Bill. So a little shout out to them.
So my favorite character, as a lot of people know, is Firestorm, and people ask me why. And I guess looking at this comment, the same sort of thing came to my mind. Is the version of the character I for whatever reason fell in love with is the one from the late 70s, early 80s, that is a little bit more whimsical, and he's still angst ridden, he's got his own problems, but it's that version that I'm, you know, that I'm really associated with, the Jerry Conway version. And it's not to say I didn't appreciate where other creators took him. So John Ostrander and the like, in the various incarnations. But yeah, that's the version of the character, you know, I fell in love with, and with the DC's New 52 titles, you know, I was like, well, there's a new Firestorm title amongst there, so I'll try that out. I think it was Gail Simone and Ethan Van Sciver. I gave it 2 issues, and it's like, no, not for me.
I don't know who's buying the stuff.
That title got canned because not enough people, obviously. But I'm not gonna support that version of the character with my dollars. I very well might pick it up, like you say, after the fact. There's eBay, and there's cheaper ways to pick this stuff up. But I don't need this version of the character to continue. I'll just pick it up out of obsession later on.
Right. You know, your life will be so much better if you can just not buy things you don't like. You know, it's hard for us. We all, as I said last time, we all have a bit of OCD to one degree or another in this hobby. It's just a matter of how much you let that control you when that kind of thing is concerned.
Yeah, and I think, so with the big two, I am not picking up any of the current DC main titles. I dip into a couple.
I was
of the
getting
Vertigo
Batwoman,
titles.
But it was what's his name?
J.H. Williams
III. and as soon as he was gone, I was too. To me, what's going on at DC these days is just this slow motion suicide, or it seems to be, but they're selling books.
Yeah, they're selling books.
Buying those 3D covers and all that stuff.
Yeah, I think they've got a whole bunch of 3D covers coming at you soon.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, I was buying a few titles for a while from the New 52, and... not buying any now, like I was saying, a couple of Vertigo books I check out occasionally, and some of the stuff for kids as well, for my boy. Marvel titles, they're doing a bunch of interesting stuff, and you know, I am collecting a few of those, but it's mainly based on the ones that are written by creators that I like, and they're getting the freedom they like to actually add their voice to it in a way that I like. It's not fully editorialized so that it's got no sense of the creator left in it.
Right. So like, yeah, the last DC book that I bought was the first issue of that new Sandman series. And that's G.H. Williams is doing the art on that.
Mm.
And I had just given Sandman a try during the fall, and I ended up just absorbing all of those very quickly. I bought trade after trade of that and read all of those and really got to like that whole thing a lot.
Mm.
And, you know, the idea of anybody doing Sandman besides the original creator is just a horrible proposition.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that that's worked out the way that it has.
Yeah, well, I think Neil Gaiman's an interesting example in the face of all the controversy that's gone around, you know, Jack Kirby and Alan Moore and, you know, arguably butchering the creations or versions of characters that those creators have put together. But Neil Gaiman, so he was involved in the Miracle Man saga. But Sandman, there's definitely a contract stipulation there, to my understanding, that there will be no version of Sandman created other than my version.
Yeah, that's great, you know.
It gives you confidence.
Right, yeah, very much so. Yeah, the, you know, because he did utilize the Kirby version of Sandman in his run.
Yeah, that was quite fun.
Yeah, yeah, and I have to imagine that if Kirby ever read that, he probably liked it okay.
Mm, it was wacky enough.
Yeah. You know, and it's really, it's mighty, mighty big of DC to not do anything with those characters because they could. You know, usually it seems like if a corporation owns these characters and they could do something, they will, as we've seen with Watchmen and as we've seen with a lot of, well, pretty much every other character that's owned by the corporate entity.
I look at all the new solicitations that come out from, you know, pretty much all the notable companies. So Marvel, DC, Image, Dark Horse, IDW, Boom Studios at the moment, and I feel like I'm missing another one. Dynamite would be the other one. And all those companies have their own distinct models at the moment, I believe. So DC's got this brutal editorial direction. Marvel is really got this Marvel Now thing where they're keeping all the big teams in multiple titles, but they're also looking for the next Hawkeye. So, you know, they're releasing things like, you know, Black Widow, Winter Soldier,
right.
The new She-Hulk.
The idea being, what are these characters do when they're not doing the Avengers bit?
Yeah, and let's put some, you know, let's put a bit of faith in the talent that we put on these books to take it in some interesting directions.
Right.
And some of them are probably a little bit hit and miss. So Hawkeye is great. Black Widow, I'm still sort of holding my judgment on that, but it's very pretty to look at, and I have a little bit of faith in Nathan Edmondson. She-Hulk is interesting. That might turn out well.
She-Hulk is good. The writer is someone I was unfamiliar with, but the artist is Javier Pulido.
Yeah, he's beautiful.
Who I think is just great. And he's doing a very Kirby-like take on the art there. Mm. And She-Hulk is a favorite character of mine from childhood, from the John Byrne run in the 80s. So it is very, very nice to be able to say hello to a new She-Hulk book and to have it be something that I find that I enjoy.
Yeah, I think they've been giving that little bit extra creative freedom. So David Aja in Hawkeye, you know, he's pushed the comics storytelling art form within the bounds of the big two anyway. I'm sure there's been some interesting stuff outside of the big two, but the stuff that he's done with Hawkeye and, you know, panel to panel and layout, and let's really try to do something a little bit more creative rather than here's nine panels on a page, follow left to right, top to bottom.
Yeah, it's very, I think he's doing some of the neatest stuff that there is right now. I think Aja is great.
So I think this Javier Pulido stuff has got a little bit of that free rein in it as well, which is nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he really seems like he's doing some experimental stuff with the page layouts.
Mm.
Also with the pacing of the book a bit.
Yeah.
You'll have to remind me, I've forgotten the name of the artist on Black Widow.
Phil Noto.
Phil Noto did some tremendous 1960s looking work with different Marvel characters, 60s and 70s, with the Avengers as well as with the X-Men.
It looks like they're the staff of Mad Men.
Right, exactly. And they look like photographs from the time. And none of his comic work ever seemed to really quite look like that art. That art had been done for his website, and he put it out on the internet that way.
Mm.
And I always wanted him to do some stuff in a comic book that would look at least a bit like the work that he did there in those pages. And this is approaching that with the Black Widow series, so I'm very happy about it. It mainly suffers because it's coming out at the same time as Velvet.
Yeah.
And they are thematically similar, and Velvet is better. So it's tough to contrast to compare.
And a little bit of a similar feeling I had, not comics, but something we were both interested in. So True Detective is right in the thick of it, and The Americans started back up this week, and I'm judging the first-ish episode of The Americans a little bit. And saying, no, don't judge it. Don't judge it like that.
Me too.
It's good on
Me
its
too.
Own.
Yeah. Me too.
You get into that. Americans, track.
I like both of those shows quite a lot. And yeah, when you compare them, and to bring it back to comics, I've been reading 100 Bullets, which is something that many people have tried to get me to do for years, and I like it. But I'm also at the same time, at roughly the exact same time that I started reading 100 Bullets, I started watching True Detective.
Yeah.
And I mean, it'll even go across.
Yeah.
Forms of entertainment that way. You know, the True Detective is some of the best stuff.
Yeah, it's funny.
There is.
Yeah, Azzarello and Risso, Eduardo Risso, is it?
Right. Yeah.
I really like the look of the stuff, and Risso is probably, I don't have enough of his stuff in my collection, but the stuff I do have, I just find beautiful. I started reading 100 Bullets. I read the first trade, and for whatever reason, I just didn't really hook me, and it was after the fact, like it had already run, so it's like, well, am I gonna buy the rest of it, or I've just had my taste and that's enough? But I love what Azzarello's done elsewhere. So Spaceman was a book they did together. That's another good partnership, yeah. Azzarello and Risso.
Yeah,
you know, that's
yeah,
a
it's a good book. The only really problem that I have with it is that it is very frequently things happen in the book, and it all hinges on some pretty wild coincidences taking place where, you know, this guy just happened to be in the same place as this guy, and they just happened to have crossed paths.
Suspension of disbelief is a bit hard to maintain.
Right. Especially after you've been watching True Detective. That's the trick. That's the only trick, really. But it's good, and it's another one of those deals where the collaboration of these two creators has really led to something fantastic that nobody else could have ever really quite taken a hold of and made into what it is.
Yeah. So going back to what I was saying about, you know, how I cruised the solicitations, that sounds a bit but if I go through the solicitations of the big companies, and I'll see, you know, okay, well, Azzarello and Risso might be on a superhero title, so well, that could be interesting. Maybe not. Maybe it will be.
Right.
You know, that's the thing I'm looking for. I'm not looking for, oh, wow, Cyclops is getting his own title. Again, he's getting a reboot. But the interesting thing for me is like Greg Rucka is the writer assigned to it. It's like, is that going to be some of Rucka's good stuff, or is he just paying the bills with that one?
Right.
But I'm still, the thing that interests me is that Greg Rucka's on it. You know, it's, but now with Image, all the solicitations, every month there's something new being solicited by, you know, a creative team that is being given the chance to publish what they believe in, and hopefully they are set up comfortably enough financially and security wise that they can go, well, this is what I really want to do, and maybe people who know me from the big two or whatever will give this a shot.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It's all comes down to who the people are that are doing the book.
Mm.
That has so much more impact on me than just who the character is. And a lot of that is that the characters that I liked as a kid were always characters who were horrible outside of being handled by key creators.
Mm.
It's a little bit trickier if you're growing up and your favorite character is Batman or, you know, Spider-Man's a bad example because there's been some pretty lousy Spider-Man comics, but mm. if you're your favorite character is one of the top characters, there's always going to be pretty good creators on those books.
Yeah.
It's always going to be near the height of the genre.
Mm.
If all you're doing is buying the Batman comic books. So,
mm.
you know, I don't know. I think it leads to a different mindset in the adult enthusiast.
Mm. Let's talk about John Byrne.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great one.
So when I first got into comics properly, so I had a few comics in my collection, but I think it wasn't until I was really 14 or 15 that I got right into them, and it was around the time of Legends, the DC miniseries with John Byrne doing the art, and that was around the time he was taking over the Superman title. And I was just
right.
looking
for essentially what had happened
John
there
Byrne.
Was that he had been very successful at Marvel and had done some pretty amazing things. So DC, eager to reboot and restart a lot of their books, which should sound familiar as it's happening again now today,
mm.
Just bought John Byrne away from Marvel.
Well, it worked for me.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he did great books. His Superman run was very good. And it was interesting because, you know, the last issue of Action before he came on was the Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow story that Alan Moore and Kurt Swan did.
Mm.
And then the very next issue, he's beating up the Teen Titans
mm.
out of nowhere. And it's, you know, it's Byrne's art style, which was, I suppose maybe cinematic would be a word for it. It seemed like John Byrne had a real a flair for the dramatic in his art that was unrivaled at the time, I feel.
Mm.
And yeah, when he was doing Legends and he was doing that stuff, I mean, that was a really big deal for him to be back at or over at DC
mm.
Taking those characters.
Yeah, it was almost like he was he wasn't taking over from what's his name, Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, in terms of, you know, this is the new DC style guy, but suddenly I think everybody was saying was associating versions of the main DC characters with the way John Byrne drew them.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And Garcia Lopez, for anyone who doesn't know, I only found out his name in the last few years, but Garcia Lopez was the guy who did all the DC character art that you saw on pretty much any piece of promotional material outside of comic books throughout mm. the 80s. One of my favorite comic artists, probably yours as well.
Yeah, yeah. I would dearly love to get hold of the DC style guide that he put together.
Yeah.
It's one of those holy grail items.
Yeah, they sell for hellacious amounts of money. But you can buy knockoff prints of the pages.
Yes.
that's the way to go. Or just download them on a computer and just stare at them.
Yeah. It's not quite the same, but there's that option.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. But yeah, Byrne was given a lot of leeway as well. During his time, he had the Superman book, which was a relaunch, and they retitled the original Superman book, Adventures of Superman. Seems to me they should have done it the other way around, but okay. And then Action Comics was sort of the DC team-up book for a while. And it was Superman having team-ups with these different characters, and it was sort of the post-crisis, your first introduction to the post-crisis version
mm.
of a lot of those characters. And then that became tricky later on editorial-wise because they started to say, well, wait a minute, is this what Hawkman is like now? Because J.M. DeMatteis wants to do him like this. And then they started having those problems.
Yeah.
But that's to be expected when you start all over again with something like that. There's so many characters to choose from, you know.
There's a guy, and this is probably more for our DC conversation that we've got planned coming up, but E. Nelson Bridwell.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And he is, and I remember in high school I had to do some sort of a general topic piece, and I did one on him at the time, and I'd only just become aware of him, but he sort of held continuity together for a long time at DC as best as it could be from what I understood.
Yeah, yeah. DC, I don't think DC ever was as great at continuity as Marvel was.
No.
And I think really the continuity becomes more of a hindrance than anything once we get to a certain point. Speaking of John Byrne, this dovetails nicely. Before he went to DC, probably his top project at Marvel, well, probably was X-Men with Chris Claremont, but after that he did the Fantastic Four, and he did some really interesting things with the Fantastic Four. And during that run, he depicted the first meeting of Reed Richards and Susan Storm as being almost like a Lolita Humbert H. Humbert type situation, where Reed Richards was a college freshman, I believe, and he was staying at a boarding house, and Susan Storm was a 12 or 13 year old girl who was in love with him at first sight. And, you know, she's depicted as sort of playing with her dollies, and he's very nervously adjusting his tie, kind of a scene. And then in the recent Fantastic Four comic books by Matt Fraction, he tossed that out completely. And he made it so that Reed and Sue met at college and were closer to the same age.
Yeah, it's probably a wise thing.
Yeah, that would tend to be my feeling on the matter. But they got an angry letter, as you can expect from someone who was incensed that they would change it, and not have some sort of a cosmic explanation for why it was changed the way that DC Comics tends to do. And Tom Brevoort, who I'm already a fan of because he gave me a no prize. I got a no prize for him. For reasons that we'll describe later on down the road. But he responded in a bit of an editorial and said, you know what? That's just not what happened anymore. You're just going to have to be okay with it. We're not going to have some cosmic thing happen where it just didn't happen. Don't worry about it. That page of that comic book that you read in 1985, frankly, is a little bit icky. We all feel comfortable with it, and we don't want it to be the way that it is, and that's not the way it is.
And we can come up with half a dozen other reasons why you're going to have to deal with it.
Right.
For instance, they haven't aged 30 years since then either, so are you okay with that?
Right, yeah. You know, Reed and Ben are no longer World War II veterans, I would suppose.
Yeah.
You know, since they've now depicted S.H.I.E.L.D. as being something that was around in the 60s, and Tony Stark has only been around in the last few years, then Tony Stark no longer formed S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah.
He just didn't. That's just the way it is. And, you know, it's the classic Mystery Science Theater 3000 intro song. You know, just remind yourself that it's just a show and you should really just relax. You know, and if you start trying to explain these things away in some sort of a story, you know, you have to come up with a story that'll make it so that everything that happened, the previous story, has never happened anymore. And it's not good for anybody. We're better off to free ourselves from.
Yeah. It's like that, like that scene from one of the Austin Powers movies where they break down the fourth wall, turn to the camera and tell you that didn't make sense, but just don't worry about it. All right, let's move on.
Yeah. Don't worry about it. Let's just keep going with this.
You know,
isn't life complicated enough that we don't have to stress your entertainment?
So you know what I do like is tracking the development of a creator and their success or lack of success story. So John Byrne obviously
certainly
became very successful and can do what he wants and is doing what he wants at the moment.
Yeah.
One of my favorite creators is only probably recently well known now is Jonathan Case for the work he did on bringing Batman 66 back to life on the
which
pages.
Which is a book that I'm very fond of. Very, very fond of.
And I don't know if many people knew before that Jonathan Case is actually an Eisner winner.
Yeah, I don't know that I was familiar with his work before the Batman 66 book. He's the artist on that, correct?
Correct. Yeah, he doesn't do all the issues because they have a sort of a rotating roster with guys like Ty Templeton, and I can't think of any of the others at the moment. And Mike Allred on covers. And
the issues that Case does are, in my opinion, far and away better than the others.
Mm.
And part of that is that I don't have, my computer isn't so hot here at home. So I'll actually go to the library and look at the digital download versions. And it's something that is actually, it's something that's even different than comic books. It's not quite animation and it's not quite a comic book page, but the work that he's doing with the online version of those Batman 66 things is just out of sight.
Yeah.
And I'm a real big fan of the show, and his work on that is just tremendous.
Yeah, he has a real knack of having that nostalgic style of art, but he's really big on technology. So he collaborated very closely with the Comixology guys on developing that stuff. So that's turned out really well.
You can really see the difference. Mm. You can it's so much more interactive when it's one that he does.
Mm.
I buy the book as it comes out monthly, and then if I see that it's one with Case, then I make a beeline for the library so I can look at the big screen on all their different computers and really, really take it in. Because yeah, the stuff that he's doing, he really understands that medium a lot.
So I've been following him probably since 2008, where he had a self-published comic he was writing and drawing called Sea Freak, and I sort of came across it from a post on one of the big comic sites at the time. And, you know, went through the rabbit warren of ways to contact some of the artists on websites at that time and managed to secure a few copies of this, this self-published thing. It was really nice, really beautiful lines, and he uses few lines to do a lot. And just sort of was wondering where he disappeared to and looked a couple of years later, and he put together that Sea Freak comic as a thing called Dear Creature. Beautiful book. I recommend anybody just go and get a copy. You can get it from his website if you're lucky. There might be some of the autographed copies with some artifacts of the artwork still there. But then he did this, he did a few little pieces, and he's a professional artist, right? So he works out of the Periscope Studios in Portland. But he does commercial art as well, right? So art for hire for agencies. Then he did a book called Green River Killer, and this is, we think it's Jeff Jensen, who is the son of one of the detectives from the Green River Killer investigation. And so it's a real life tale, and the artwork is just phenomenal. And they ended up winning an Eisner for that bit of work. Highly recommend it. So, you know, was really keen on anything that he was developing, and I actually commissioned a sketch from him, so I'm very proud of that. And I was very proud that he featured it on his blog as well. That was nice.
That's great.
So when I saw a bit of a hint of following him on Twitter and Jeff Parker, a writer that I quite like sometimes, I saw this sort of hint where they were not saying anything of what happening, but all I knew was Jeff Parker was probably going to be writing something and Jonathan Case was probably going to be drawing it, and whatever it was.
Oh, I remember that.
Whatever it was, I was in for it. And a couple of days later, the Batman 66 stuff got announced. It's like, wow, is a tremendous break, and I'm really happy for the guy that I feel like I have some sort of relationship with through over the years. But just seeing that develop and going, I just knew this guy. was going to make it somehow. Actually, one of the projects was a book called The Creep that he did with John Arcudi. And I thought, right, so he is now drawing a book that John Arcudi is writing. Big things are going to happen next. And
yeah.
It was a nice little thing to see happen, and now he's a busy man. He's a busy, busy man.
Yeah, it's interesting that he's had so many disparate projects, because he's got such a great handle on that very specific Batman 1966 feel.
Mm.
I mean, he's all over that. He does that perfectly.
Yeah, yeah. I think. And he gets a lot of commission requests, and he does beautiful. I've not seen one that he hasn't knocked out of the park. He really digs it, but it feels like people are only asking for Batman 66 stuff or Julie Newmar Catwoman. You know, he's done a lot of Julie Newmar. There was a funny tweet he sent out, and he said, "Oh, you know, just receiving emails from Julie Newmar with pictures of her as Catwoman." Living the dream.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the Batman 66, it has its own fan base.
Mm.
To be certain, I'm one of them. Mm. And you know, that's definitely an interesting a personal history that I've had with that, because as a kid I liked it, as a teenager I didn't like it at all, and then as I got older I started to take myself and the medium a lot less seriously and began to develop a real affinity for it.
Mm.
And today it's probably one of my most favorite versions of Batman.
It's hard not to like.
Yeah, I mean, really. I mean, unless you're just a real curmudgeon about it. Take it a little bit too seriously, then maybe, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, he does tremendous work, and I'm very happy for him. That's good news.
That's a journey I want to follow.
Yeah, well, it's great that he goes from being an Eisner Award-winning guy to being somebody that people have heard of. You know, he wins the award before any sort of great notoriety comes his way.
Yeah, yeah.
And it goes to show that sometimes you can work for yourself and then work for the big two and not the other way around.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And find success that way.
Yeah, I think... it's an interesting thing about creators. I forget which. I think it was Sean Murphy, an artist I really like as well. I believe it was him, or he was quoting somebody else's. You know my style. Don't hire me to do somebody else's style. You hire me for my style, or don't hire me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't,
exactly.
Don't hire me for my success and then ask me to be someone else.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're in a place now where it, you know, it used to be that, you know, like at the Marvel days, the deal was, we'll just draw like Kirby. What are you doing that for? Draw like, no, Kirby is the guy. Draw like Kirby.
Yeah.
And then it was only over a few years that started to not be the case so much.
Yeah.
So yeah, now I think that's I mean, I don't really know the inside workings of a lot of the stuff, but I think that now it seems like artists are getting to do their own thing and to be able to work in their own styles probably a bit more frequently than they used to.
That's a good way to wrap up this conversation.
Yep.
Let's do it again next week.
You got it.